Hello and welcome to Nine Inch Charge. Welcome to the Old World Show. Dan here. It's been a while since I've had Jeremy on the stream, and we've been trying to record this for a little while, but schedules and life and things have just got in the way. But finally, Jeremy is here. Welcome, Jeremy.
Hey, nice to be back on again.
And we're going to talk about Dark Elves, and we're going to talk specifically about Dark Elf lore. It's a subject that I don't know too much about, if I'm honest. I know what it's like to be on the receiving end of a Dark Elf army, that's for sure. But Jeremy is here. He's got all his books at the ready. And we're going to talk Dark Elf lore. I'm just going to kick us off by reading this flavor text from the wiki. And then we'll kind of go from there and meander here, there, and everywhere. But just before we get into that, make sure you click like. If you haven't subscribed, make sure you subscribe if you're a regular viewer. YouTube analytics is telling me that lots of people are coming back to watch, but not everybody who comes back to watch is subscribing. They're getting it through notifications and stuff like that. So if you're a frequent viewer and you haven't yet subscribed, please consider just, there's a button just somewhere around. It'll be somewhere around here. All right. Dark Elves. The Dark Elves, or the Druishi as they call themselves in their own tongue, also known as Naggarothi or the Dark Ones, are one of the most ancient, powerful, and certainly the most sadistic of the three elven civilizations in the world. In the bleak, chilly lands of the continent of Naggaroth in the New World lies the Dark Elven kingdoms of the Witch King Malekith. A realm born from the depths of malice and hate, a kingdom that seeks nothing more than to despoil the world its people believe loathes their existence. With malevolent eyes, the Dark Elves watch this dying world, knowing that it is their birthright to rule all that they survey, and those that live upon it are born to do nothing more than grovel at their feet.
That gets me quite patriotic and misty-eyed there, I've got to say.
So, Jeremy, with that flavour text read, what is it that you love so much about Dark Elves?
So why do you like Dark Elves? Well, basically, just from what you said above, they sort of combine that that flair for like being evil, sadists, cool. They combine that level of sort of like elegance, but also being maliciously evil. I always kind of knew on to sort of a bad guy army because I always think the bad guys are far more fun than the goodies. But I kind of wanted an army that wasn't so much a sort of evil horde sort of charging over the horizon, but could be sort of sneaky and stylish. We're Star Trek fans, and I often say that my favourite army is was the Romulans, and obviously the Romulans are basically just evil space elves. So I think there's already that sort of natural affinity there anyway. We were also kind of like, back when we were young, kind of like enjoyed a bit of rock, a bit of metal, and they're basically just sort of like evil metal elves, Dan, really, aren't they? You've got to be honest.
I was just thinking back to the last dream where you said there was a cabinet revolving around, and then it was like dragon. Elves riding dinosaurs, naked women.
Yeah, I was toying with the idea of saying that again, but basically, yeah, there was a cabinet, really nicely painted army, snowy bases, coated like black, purple, pale skin. Yeah, it was the evil goth army of elves. It was awesome. They have pirates, they have ninjas, they have elves and dinosaurs. They got bikini clad women. They've got pretty much anything that a teenage boy would want. So why settle for less, really?
Yeah, I think that is a perfect summary, Jeremy, of why Dark Elves are cool and why you'd want to collect them, I think. And I completely agree. So I want to talk about, I want to go back right to the beginnings and the sort of the foundation of the race. I'm just going to touch on that a bit. And then I think we're going to go up to the current timeline in where we know the game, the Old World, is going to be set. And then after that, we'll do a bit of wish listing and just go off the rails.
Sounds good.
Okay, so I've been doing a bit of reading about Malekith because he's a really, really interesting character because he is the son of Anarion, the first Phoenix King. And people would say by rights, therefore the heir to Ulthuan and should be the next Phoenix King. But when Anarion died, it was decided that actually there'd been a big season of war kind of already. And although Malkith was very accomplished. You know, he was given Marathi skill at diplomacy and duplicity, and he had an Aryan skill in combat. Actually, they didn't need a great warrior. They needed someone to bring a bit of balance and to help rebuild the civilization. And I think Malekith was seen more as being this great warrior in the line of an Aryan. So they chose someone called Bel-Shinnar to be the next Phoenix King, who the Dark Elves call the Peddler King.
That's right, yeah.
And Malekith went off around the world doing different things and went on different excursions and adventures and fought more wars and things like that. But when he came back to Ulthuan, there were all these different cults of pleasure and things like that going on. And actually, it wasn't the Ulthuan that he remembered. And I think he was thinking to himself, well, this is my birthright, and I could have done a better job than this bloke who's just come in and just ruined everything. So he came in kind of with the plan to seek his birthright and to become the next Phoenix King and put himself into the flames of the Phoenix. So for those of you who don't know, the way you become Phoenix King is to go to the Phoenix Temple and put yourself into the flames of the Phoenix, get completely burned, and then reborn as the Phoenix King. And this is something that an Aryan did to become Phoenix King. And when he came out, he was all like glistening and glowing, and he was reborn basically. And when Malekith stepped into the flames, obviously the flames are searing and burning and painful and start stripping away your hair and your flesh. And it's all like, was very graphically described actually in the books and in the lore. It's quite terrifying, really, what you have to put yourself through. But Malekith was quite confident that he'd be fine. But actually the flames and the pain overwhelmed him, and he sort of threw himself back out of the flames. But then he was just, unfortunately, a charred, horrible mess, I guess, on the floor, sort of melted to the floor of this temple. And
he'd been barbecued, really.
Yeah. And from that point on, he is by rights, at least in his own mind, and then we can talk about end times later on, he is by rights the Phoenix King. He never actually got to take the throne and become the Phoenix King because he didn't endure the flames. And then that sparked a civil war. And then this is kind of where we are. That's the very foundations of the Dark Elf Nation. They went over to Naggarond into the new world and set up camp there. And it fractured and split the entire elven race. It turns out that actually, you tell me what you think happened in the end times, and then I'll tell you what happened, because I know you don't have much interest in the end times.
I have got very little interest and very, very dismissive attitude, so, which is, very, very in character for the race. Something about Malekith turning out to have been good all along, and that actually he should have passed through the flames, but they didn't, I don't know, press the magic button or something. it kind of sounds like someone like saying, oh, Skeletor from He-Man. Oh, yeah, he was actually good, really. All that evil cackling and murder and torture and massacres, it was only evil from a certain point of view. It's the Obi-Wan Kenobi excuse. I don't know. What actually happened, Dan? You tell me.
Well, I don't think that it turned out that he was good all along, but it turned out that he should have been the Phoenix King all along. Mm. And actually, you do have millennia of him being evil and twisted, and Marathi feeding him poison. Well, not literal poison, but you know what I mean? Like corrupting
him. Manipulation.
Manipulating him and all this kind of stuff and all this hate building up for millennia. And that doesn't go away. But it also doesn't change the fact that actually he should have been the true ruler. And in the end, he does step into the flames and he does endure it. And he is reborn as the Phoenix King. And just as he emerges from the flames as the Phoenix King, Ulthuan crumbles into the sea and is ultimately destroyed.
Is that because he became the Phoenix King, or is that just a very unfortunate coincidence?
It's because the world is ending, basically. And also, it turns out that all the subsequent Phoenix Kings, none of them could stand the flames either. And there wasn't actually a true Phoenix King. What they were doing was, whether the Phoenix Kings knew it or not, was the mages were using their magic to temper the flames and make them survivable.
Oh, that seems quite high elf,
Yeah. So that's what happened. And ultimately, it was proven, you know, to a lot of Dark Elf. I think there's a lot of, obviously we know that the End Times is a bit controversial, but to a lot of Dark Elf players, not the guy who burned his army after the End Times, as we all remember, but to a lot of other Dark Elf players, it was a bit, I guess, of kind of, I don't really know what the word is, justice, finally, I suppose, some recognition that actually all along we were telling you for millennia. And yeah, he was the true Phoenix King. But I always think of him as being a bit like Darth Vader, because he was the chosen one who ended up charred and clad in dark armor. And then by the end, in the End Times, you know, he had this sort of final moment where he was like, he was all right. Maybe in Age of Sigma, he would come back as a blue ghost.
A very, very large, elaborate, and very fragile model, perhaps. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the Darth Vader analogy works, because then you have Morathi as like the emperor, like the person who's actually responsible for the corruption and like pulling all the strings behind. Yeah, it works nicely.
So so that is how the race began. There was a big split and a big schism. There's a lot more to it than that, obviously. But that's kind of the bare bones of how the Dark Elves got started, as far as I can remember. But we're going to skip forward now, and we're going to go all the way up to the year 2201 of the Imperial calendar, where in Bretonnia, Lewin Auxlair has launched his errantry wars. But meanwhile, in the dark, cold land of Naggarhond, what is going on, Jeremy?
Yeah, so when I started off preparing for this, I basically went through all the old books. I've got them all here. So you've got like the 4th edition book here, the 6th edition, and so on and so on. And basically just, I pulled out a list of things that we knew going back. And it was kind of interesting to see actually how the lore had changed. Definitely from the original book, so the slightly comic strip style there, the main big thing that was going on with the Dark Elves was preparing for the Great Chaos Incursion of 2301. So this is when the Dark Elves are going to invade Uthran with support from Chaos, and where it's going to be where the Everqueen is saved by Tyrion and the Witch King is defeated at the Battle of Fingal, if I'm pronouncing that right, Fields, where his champion Urien Poisonblade is killed by Tyrion. And that's also the point at which Teclis goes off to support Magnus the Pious to help fight Chaos in the Old World.
Sets up the Colleges of Magic.
Indeed, yeah. So initially in the first book, that's kind of where we are, kind of in the build-up for that invasion. Then I went on to the 6th edition book. This was very hard to tell because it's not written as a timeline. It's one long narrative. It's basically one story written from the Dark Elves perspective. So it's incredibly biased. And it's very, very hard to work out actually what's true and what basically just the Dark Elf storytellers just made up to sound impressive to whoever's listening.
Well, this is why, Jeremy, I've got you on as a historian, because you can wheedle out the biases. And, you know, we know history is written by the victors, but as someone with a history degree from a prestigious English university, I expect you to be able to pull out the truths and the untruths, I suppose.
Well, as an academic, I guess I have to fudge and say, well, how can we ever really know what is knowledge? But what the claims made are that they were attacking Cathay, at this time taking 100,000 prisoners in one day. Which is quite a lot. Possibly that figure's over exaggerated by the Dark Elves. But I didn't say that. And they're also starting to attack the Old World and forcing dwarves, humans, and orcs to start to work in the forges of Naggarhond, the capital, to start building arms and weapons for their future wars. It's also kind of a time when they start exploring Lustria and start raiding the temples of the Slann. Initially, they make off with some quite good loot, but unfortunately, after that point, the Lizardmen have a massive grudge and are determined to get their stuff back, and they start raiding and harassing the Dark Elves ever since that point. It's also kind of cool reading this book because obviously we talked about the invasion of Uthran just above. In this book, the Dark Elf storyteller complains that it was the forces of Chaos that let them down and nothing to do with the Dark Elves being incompetent. So it was very definitely Chaos's fault. And that Malekith didn't run tail between his legs back through the realm of Chaos to survive, but actually made a strategic withdrawal at the opportune point.
I think it's funny, isn't it? Because there's a point at which the writers of these narratives want to show the Dark Elves doing all these things in the world, but also they have to maintain everything the same, if you know what I mean. You know, they can't actually ever defeat Ulthuan, because then there won't be a High Elf race and people won't be able to play games with High Elves. So you have to kind of write these narratives where they're doing all these things. And then ultimately, as you said, making strategic withdrawals and building up again and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
For me, this represents a kind of golden era of Dark Elves, because there was a point in the past where the Dark Elves weren't seen as a threat by the High Elves, and they thought that they hadn't really heard anything from them, and they thought they'd pretty much been wiped out in previous wars and things. And now they've been building themselves up and building themselves up to the point where they're kind of, you know, we're less than 100 years away from launching an invasion, a full-scale invasion into Ulthuan, which in a life of an elf is a blink of an eye, and everything is kind of reaching ahead and coming to fruition. And they are, I think what got me really excited was that you don't all, because there was never really naval battles, it's difficult sometimes to think of Warhammer armies as seafaring nations, even though you did have the Corsairs and things like that. But this is kind of the height of Dark Elf piracy on the high seas, I suppose.
It really is.
And what's brilliant about the way that they go about their piracy is that because they're so duplicitous, and because they're so sneaky, and because they're so good at spying, you know, they, going back probably a couple of millennia, there was a Phoenix King who was killed by a Dark Elf assassin who had infiltrated his own court, and, you know, was one of the Phoenix King's closest advisors. So you can imagine how easy it would be for a Dark Elf to infiltrate a shipping company, for example. And actually, the Dark Elves, by this time, if a High Elf fleet, treasure fleet or something like that, is sailing on the high seas, the Dark Elves know when it's dispatched and when it's going to land before the High Elves do. And they know all the shipping routes, and they are just kings of doing this and plundering and doing all this kind of stuff. And then also the other side of it, I suppose, is something that has always been in the lore but never described in through models or anything like that, is how many, but it is, they do talk about them having slaves in battles. Yes, how many slaves they're taking. And actually, there's a massive slave economy, and this goes back to what I guess the flavor text in the beginning, where they think it's their birthright to rule over everyone and everyone has to grovel at their feet, and they should be slaves, and they should enslave the whole world, and all this kind of stuff is happening for the Dark Elves in this time. And if you are a Dark Elf, I suppose this must be kind of an age of optimism, and that you think that everything is about to go right, and then we get 100 years later and it hasn't. But for the moment, I think it's a good time to be a Dark Elf.
It's good to be king.
Yeah,
so as we move into kind of 7th and 8th edition, we started to come up with a bit more detail about what the Dark Elves are doing around the rest of the world and start to flesh it out a bit. And as you said, it is kind of like a period of exploration and mass piracy. 7th and 8th edition books couldn't really decide on what these eras are called. So in 7th, we have the gloriously titled Time of Vengeance, which is 1783 to 2423. And in 8th edition, we have the Age of Glorious Torment. So, I don't know, pick your poison, but either way, they're having fun and they're being slightly mean about it. But yeah, some of the things they're doing is exploring the east. So there's a great one where they attack a cafe town, block off all the escape routes, and then drop in the witch elves, and then the witch elves do what witch elves do, and then everyone's massacred.
Paint the town red, I think is what you say, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that is literally what happens. Yep. And then they bugger off before the dragon emperor can turn up to sort it out. There's also a town in the east where the witch king visits personally, and he boils the blood in the veins of the city's mystics, and then summons a tsunami to wipe the town off the map, because why go, you know, make halfway efforts. And then obviously we've got the time that the Fellheart family, so Fellheart was a special character corsair with a really cool like Cthulhu like golden mask that I think he stole maybe from maybe I can't remember what the Warhammer name for what was basically India is.
Ind.
was it Ind? Oh, there we go. I think Figgy basically steals that mask from Ind. So the Felhalt family start raiding Ind and Cathay at that point as well. But yeah, there's also a lot of stuff going on in the old world as well, to bring it more into the game and the era that we're talking about. So with attacks on Tilia, Estalia, the Empire, and Bretonnia. And one of my favourites was in Indusia, which is in Tilia, where some shades stole all the kids from the parents one night, then offered to ransom them back. And then the city basically assembles all the people on the shore or the beach with all their wealth. And then the Dark Elves storm ashore, slaughter everyone, which I kind of think is kind of like the Amazon Prime of Warhammer Fantasy massacres, where you want all the gold but can't be bothered to gather it yourself, so you get them to come to you. Which again, yeah, seems like a very very Dark Elf thing to do. And also, while the Empire is going through its civil war, the Dark Elves are having a lot of fun with all of the confusion and raiding Marienburg on their Helldrakes, which are basically giant sea serpents with like mini turrets stuck to the back. If you've ever seen the old Games Workshop game Man of War, where there was like a naval engagement thing, they were actually like models for them as well. And they were like setting light to Empire ships and then pushing them into the harbour to ignite all the others. And then the Bretonnia, like there was a Beast Lord Rakarth. He was using Hydras to attack and tear down the gates of a Bretonnian city. And there was also another place in Nordland in the Empire where it was a coastal town where people were just sort of flayed and nailed to the tops of cliffs. So that's everything we managed to get from the 7th edition book. And then, just to make life more interesting, in the 8th edition book, the dating system changes from the Dark Elf dating system to the Imperial dating system. So who knows really what's going on, but it basically looks like they're basically, again, raiding and plundering to sort of gather wealth to attack the High Elves and plundering the world. But one of the things I found looking in the 8th edition book, which I kind of forgot about, was kind of going back to what you were saying, really, was the fact that they are going to the High Elf courts, trying to sow discontent and making sure the High Elves are just sort of being undermined quietly. They're sending their ambassadors around to be alluring and charming. So actually they're using a lot of soft diplomatic power, and they take advantage of the fact that lots of Dark Elves are members of the pleasure cults to try and sort of basically seduce and sort of wheedle their way into to court. So even when the Dark Elves massacre a population, they can next turn up and be really, really nice and sweet about it and try and win people over again with remarkable success, because they're elves and therefore very, very beguiling.
It's something quite, I don't know if it's ironic, it's something quite interesting about that it was the pleasure cults that led to Malekith wanting to become the Phoenix King and restore everything, and he wanted to put his mother into prison because he thought she was head of all these pleasure cults, and now he's using the pleasure cults to sow dissent into Ulthuan.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and just basically to try to undermine them and turn them into basically what they're fighting against, which is clever. You'll really like this one, Dan. So it turns out they tried this trick of trying to beguile and charm the Wood Elves, and so they turned up in the woods. The Wood Elves listened very politely and then politely asked the Dark Elves to leave and never return. So they weren't having any of it.
So what happened actually there is the Wood Elves are kind of refound because it wasn't known that there were Wood Elves to the High Elves for a long time. They didn't realise. They thought that all the Elves had returned back to Ulthuan, and then this split happened, and then all of a sudden there's Wood Elves. So then both races think, right, well, let's get these Elves on side. And it just so happens that both diplomatic parties of High Elves and Dark Elves arrive at Athel Lorraine at the same time. And there's this kind of pantomime going on where they have to keep them all separate, and they have to, luckily they can manipulate the forest, and, you know, there's probably like a row of trees, and just the other side is like the High Elf contingent from the Dark Elves and things like that.
Can you imagine like the Elves like with their ears like against the trees? Can you hear some Elves coming through?
So they do ask the Dark Elves to leave and never return. The Wood Elves aren't too interested. However, there is an interesting part where Ariel and Orion go after Marathi because she's evil, obviously. And she's just such a master manipulator. She's just, you know, like you said, like she's the one pulling all the strings. She's like the emperor in Star Star Wars in this situation. And they get to the point where they've got her in her tower. Ariel and Orion are there. And Orion is just about to push his spear kind of like through her heart and just kill her. And she just says to Ariel, "I'll teach you a bit of dark magic." and then it causes all kinds of chaos for the Wood Elves. And actually, they do kind of get one over the Wood Elves, because at that point, Ariel is then seduced by Marathi, and she locks herself away in the treehouse that she lives in for centuries and never comes out. And she has to go through this kind of long period of coming to terms with all the dark secrets that she knows, and the fact that she's been tainted by dark magic, and before she was really pure. And she can emerge, when she emerges, she's more herself again, but never quite the same. And she has this kind of bit of taint to her that carries on for the rest of her life. And so no one, even if the delegation of her elves that were sent there, no one is safe from the manipulation of Marathi.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
Like I said, that kind of takes us through where we are with them at the current time. Lots of really cool things going on, lots of monsters, lots of plundering, all this kind of stuff. Those Helldrake things sound absolutely incredible. Is that what they were called? Sea serpents?
Basically, yeah, Helldrakes. I mean, Man of War is a game where maybe the miniatures haven't aged terribly well, but the concept behind them is quite fun and deep. I always kind of like the idea of like a dark elf navy, floating castles, black arcs, and floating sea serpents. So yeah, there's a lot of fun to be had there.
This kind of takes us on to the next thing I wanted to talk about quite nicely, which was, I guess, a wish list of units that you would want to see. So I'll kick us off, because for me, it's a range that's still current, that you can still buy. I want to see more Dark Elf Pirates. I want them just to go over the edge with that, because it is, like we said, the height of seafaring, the height of plundering. I want to see more Corsairs. I want to see the range expanded. I want to see legendary heroes and legendary captains and things like that. And I want to see... the other thing I would like to see is slaves. And Skaven had slaves, and Dark Elves had slaves, but Dark Elves never had slave models. And like I said, there were interesting things in the lore about, just sending the slaves forward, and sometimes even just mowing them down with their own arrows, just so they'd be an interference on the battlefield to slow down the approach of oncoming armies.
Yeah.
This is what Dark Elves think of people from other lands. But I think for me, it's those two. And I just would really like to see some of the other heroes come back. I want to see Malus Darkblade back. I want to see a new model for him. And I think they could do some amazing stuff like they did with Marathi when she came out for Age of Sigmar, where you got little Marathi and big Marathi, and you could do like the demon form of Malus Darkblade. I think that would be really cool.
That's great. I never thought that. It's a great idea. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, I'm kind of with you on the fact that I'd like them to lean more into sort of the nautical aspect of it. I'd like to see, be like Corsairs armed with nets or harpoons or more different weapon options or different classes of Corsair. And maybe some more sea monsters. I do quite like some the sea beasts that kind of fly into combat for the new sea race of elves for Age of Sigmar. I can't remember what they're called now.
The Idoneth Deepkin, and I don't judge you for not knowing that, because it's quite an odd name, the Idoneth Deepkin. But that was kind of, I was thinking of that actually, because they've got Alapexes, which it's funny that there's a bit in the new GoTrek series that's voiced by Brian Blessed, where he sees the Deepkin, and they've got these things called Alapexes, and on the back of the Alapexes are like harpoon riders, but they are just sharks. And GoTrek just calls things out, doesn't he? He's like, "They're sharks!" And you can just see, I think it's great, because there's been all this talk of Games Workshop trying to protect their IP and having things that are only copyrightable and choosing certain names and not having things that are generic. And then GoTrek just storms in. It's just like, "I'm having none of it. That's a shark."
It's a shot of the bolt thrower. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I think it'd be cool to see some stuff like that.
And then the other thing I kind of would like to see is I'd kind of rereading the lore. I kind of forgotten about like the power of like the pleasure cults, and so I kind of like to see something a bit, I don't know, a bit culty. I don't know, almost like kind of like civilians in robes or something like that. I don't quite know what they would do or how they would work, but it'd be interesting to see something which kind of had, I don't know, like a more subtle role potentially in that. It'd be cool.
I think I'd like to see as well. I'd like to see a rule set where. We talked about all this infiltration and all this knowledge that they have of the opposing force before they even engage them. I'd like to see that play out as a rule. So when I played Wood Elves, the general could loose an arrow and it would start the battle. The arrow would be loosed and it would sink itself into the heart of the opponent. They'd have to take like a strength 3 or 4 hit before the game started. But I'd like to see a rule kind of like that, something maybe before the game started, but it might be like, for example, you could pick a unit and the enemy might have to reveal if there was a fanatic or an assassin or something like that in the unit, just something like that to represent all the groundwork that they've been doing in the lore before they even go into battle. That goes back to what I said initially, where the Dark Elves, you've got to accept that they're just 3 steps ahead of you at all times.
Something like that would be fun. Yeah, I'd like to see them lean more into the blood magic stuff as well. Like, I really like the Dagger of Slaughter, whatever it was called, where you could basically kill your models to generate more blood magic.
And yeah.
All that sort of stuff. That feels very fluffy, and it kind of gives them a kind of... I'd like to like almost see that built in, because it kind of adds that a lot of character and flavour in the same way that some of like the Skaven rules do, or some of the Aminosity rules for like...
And that's why they need slaves, because they wouldn't do it to a Dark Elf. Because they're the Dark Elves, and they're you know, it's their birthright to rule and conquer the whole world. And, you know, I guess if they needed to slaughter some of their own on the way to do it, they would do. But actually, this is why they keep slaves. They'd kill a High Elf. 100% they'd kill a High Elf instead. You know, and they would absolutely revel in bringing a High Elf to battle with them. You know, and they probably, you know, this is some of the things that they do, you know, the horrible things that you hear that happen in some countries on death row and things, where they say, like, today it's going to be you, and then it turns out that it's not, and they would love to do that to people. They've probably got an elf, you know, a high elf that they've got for 2,000 years, and every day they tell him he's going to be slaughtered, and every day he's not, and they just, you know, he's probably had millennia of having to endure this kind of psychological brutality. So, yeah, I think that's why they need slaves. But I think that takes us kind of to the end of what we were going to talk about. So do you have any last words, Jeremy, before the executioner swings his glaive?
No, just can't wait to see them back again with for the old world and see what new models the GW decided to bring out for them. Can't wait.
Yeah. All right. So thank you very much, everyone, for watching. Thank you, Jeremy, for joining. Me and Jeremy are going to be back at some point, because me and Jeremy have been talking quite extensively about Cathay. And we know there's been an article. We know there's been an update. We had this Dark Elf one planned for a long time in advance, and we wanted to do that first. But we will be back. I can't say when, hopefully not before too long, and we'll be talking about Cathay yet again. As I said, thank you very much for watching. Make sure you click that like button, because it just helps the channel grow and helps people find us. And we will catch you next time.